Episode 39 with Sherry Maples.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Welcome to the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Seiko Rode. And in this podcast, I talk with meditation and mindfulness practitioners. These are practitioners from all kinds of wisdom traditions, any kind of wisdom tradition, basically, that has some kind of mindfulness or meditation contemplative aspect to it. And with the guests, we examine the benefits and the challenges of these types of practices and how to integrate them into our daily lives. And it's interesting to talk with different guests from totally different walks of life and to see how they've integrated and brought these practices into their daily lives in this century. There's a lot to learn. So in this episode, I talk with Sherry Maples. And Sherry Maples is a Dharma teacher, keynote speaker, and organizational consultant. And she was ordained in 2008 with Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, or Thay, and he is her longtime spiritual teacher. Sherry has worked for 25 years in the criminal justice system as an assistant attorney general in the Wisconsin Department of Justice, the head of probation and parole for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, as well as a police officer with the City of Madison Police Department, where she ended up earning the rank of Captain of Personnel and Training. Sherry has been an active community organizer, working in neighborhood centers, deferred prosecution programs, and as a first director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She's also been past president of the Dane County Time Bank, where Sherry was instrumental in creating its justice projects, the Youth Court, which is based on prevention and restorative justice model, and the Prison Project, which is a prison education and reintegration initiative supported by multiple community groups. And she has incorporated all these experiences in her mindfulness practice. Sherry's interest in criminal justice professionals comes from learning that peace in one's own heart is a prerequisite to providing true justice and compassion to others. She's fond of using the quote by Cornel West, which is, "Justice is what love looks like in public." While her initial focus was on translating the language and practice of mindfulness into an understandable framework for criminal justice professionals, Sherry's work has also evolved to include other helping professionals such as healthcare workers, teachers, and employees of social service agencies. And these are all folks and professions who also must manage the emotional effects of their work while maintaining an open heart and healthy boundaries. And Sherry is currently a licensed attorney and licensed clinical social worker in the state of Wisconsin. So with that, let's get right into the interview with Sherry Maples. Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for joining me on this podcast.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know you are part of the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, and so am I. And I'm just curious how you got started with meditation and a mindfulness practice. What brought you to actually end up going to a retreat?
Well, it's either a series of coincidences or miracles. I don't take sides in the debate over that. But actually, I certainly was open to the whole idea of meditation and mindfulness, but about 7 years into my police career, I was a street sergeant at the time. I had a back injury that came from lifting a moped out of the trunk of a squad car. And I went to a chiropractor that was just a few doors down from where I reported for work every day. And in her waiting room, she had the book Being Peace. And so I picked it up and I was reading it while I was waiting, and I was interested. And so I got my own copy, started reading it. And then when I went back again, by this time, I'd been ordered off work for a couple of weeks, and when I went back again, there was this flyer up for a retreat in Mundelein, Illinois. And this was in 1991, the summer of 91, I believe. And So I decided to go. Didn't know really anything about it or much about it. It was a week-long retreat, and in those days, Thay, as we affectionately call Thich Nhat Hanh,
right,
which, as you know, is translated as teacher. He did everything. Sister Chong Kong might have been with him, but it was a seven-day retreat, and most of it was silent, and we had Dharma talks by Thay and question and answer sessions and Dharma discussion groups. But other than that, it was quiet. And of course, we were taught sitting, walking, and eating meditation. And for me, it was just so lovely to stop. And I got really, really interested in the practice. And I just started practicing. I didn't really even understand Buddhism until much later, but by the time I started reading it, I had an intuitive understanding of it from practicing.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular moments during that retreat that woke up something in you that where you decided, you know, this is something I need to investigate further?
Oh, there were several. I can remember eating meditation the first time I ever did it, as I was such a fast eater, especially as a cop. You know, you try to get some food, and it always was an invitation for a red light and siren call, so you were wolfing things down as fast as you could before the next call. And so to actually slow down and taste my food and be with it and think about where it came from and all of those things was a wonderful experience for me, but as was sitting and walking meditation. And of course, as you know, just watching Thay walk into a room is like a Dharma talk all in of itself.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
The bells, they were beautiful bells, not just the bells that were invited in our sessions, but this was on a Catholic college campus, so there were bells going off all the time. And we would just stop and take three breaths every time we heard any kind of bell. And that was wonderful. And of course, that's also the retreat where I asked what I thought were some very hard questions. I came with a chip on my shoulder. I didn't want anybody to know that I was a cop. I was sure that I would be pigeonholed, and people always assume they know what my politics are, what I like to eat, nothing besides donuts or anything, what my education is. And so I didn't say much. And then there was this whole thing about the five mindfulness trainings, and somebody asked me if I was going to take them, and I said, well, I can't take these, I'm a cop. And then in a question and answer session, I asked Thay about it, and that's where he said, well, who else would we want to carry a gun except somebody who will do it mindfully?
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the five mindfulness trainings and started going to a sangha that was formed after that retreat, and slowly just started developing a practice.
Right, and then when you came back out in the world, it changed the quality of, and your even your intentionality about how you confronted the violence of the day-to-day stuff, because you said somewhere that there's a lot of consumption of violence that police officers have to go through.
Oh, I don't think anybody faces the consequences and results of racism and poverty and violence on a daily basis more than cops. I had a very, very powerful experience right after the retreat that really taught me a lot. And what that was is I came back and I went back to work, and I literally couldn't understand why everybody around me had changed. Even the people I was arresting, it just seemed like they'd gotten kinder in my absence. And, you know, it was the energy I was putting out. And it was such a powerful experience for me to realize that. And it's not like it lasted, but I dipped into something that I knew was very, very important and that I could come back to. And The other thing is, as I started realizing over time, we're talking incremental changes here, but that it was possible to start every call with the intention not to do further harm, even if force was required, not to do further harm.
Right. I have an example, too, because that's one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you about this as well, because I remember going to the airport to pick up my wife, and I must not have noticed the sign, the speed sign, and I must have gone a little bit too fast. So a police officer pulled me over, and as he was walking up to the car, and this was after I'd practiced quite a bit, and I may have gone to a retreat, you know, maybe a week earlier or something. I was at a very still place and a peaceful place. My heart was calm at that time, and I could see the stress on the officer's face and the almost a look of, I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, like the expectation that something is, that there's going to be an argument back and forth. It was eye-opening to me because I realized that my own state of mind was then shifting his state of mind, and you could just tell, you could see some of these, the tension drop off his face when he realized he was just talking to a normal, you know, a calm person. And it made me realize how important it is, the quality of our being that we bring to every interaction and every encounter.
It's so true, isn't it? And I love that example because, again, I think it's such a powerful example of how energy follows thought, and that what we tend to put out bounces back at us. And so many of these things that are, so many of the awful things that are happening right now, the unnecessary use of deadly force, the unnecessary use of force, period. I often wonder in these interactions that happen. Of course, the responsibility should be with the professional, but I often wonder if either person in the interaction was just able to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
You say, you know, bring some, just start turning that volume down, what would happen? Whether it was the police officer or somebody like yourself who is trying to bring some stillness to that interaction, it makes a huge difference. And what you saw is what happens a lot of times. Police officers are taught and to expect the worst from people, and they're taught that their safety depends on it. And I think that is the whole thing that has to be reexamined.
Right. And like you mentioned somewhere else, they put on all this armor in advance. So there's already this kind of expectation that you have to be, you know, armed to the teeth and armed and put all this body armor, which almost is like a reflection on that state of being of there might be tension.
Well, it just imagine going to work and having to change. And with that change comes, and I have small children, so I always kept everything in my locker, but you're putting on a uniform, but before you even put on the outer clothing of a uniform with a badge, et cetera, you're putting on a bulletproof vest, and you're putting on a gun belt, and you're putting other weapons besides just a gun on that gun belt. And yeah, you're literally putting armor on. You're preparing for work by putting armor on. And in most places now, bulletproof vests are required. They're not optional.
Right. And I guess one of the things that I wanted to explore was a lot of rational type of thinking would say, well, you've got to do this. But there's something, and Thich Nhat Hanh calls that, I think he calls that the miracle of mindfulness, because there's something that happens when you inner disarm and when you, like you mentioned, that bring that stillness or have that peace in your heart that then de-escalates the person or whatever encounter you have. And it's very hard to explain because a lot of people would first say, well, you gotta, you know, be proactive. And, you know, like, for example, with these wars as well, I think it can be extrapolated to all kinds of institutions like the military as well, where there's an immediate reaction to a provocation as opposed to this deep listening and calming, a more calmer approach and a response rather than a reaction.
Well, and we've seen what happens. I mean, right now we're, Ty would be the first to say that you can't fight violence with violence. And it's so interesting because I think that until we start learning from history, this will probably continue. And we've just seen that in the history books that, we tried to humiliate the Germans, and which gave a springboard to Hitler. And then we bombarded Cambodia in 73, and we saw that that was fodder for the recruitment campaign of Khmer Rouge, and then the war in Iraq, how that became, it really led to Islamist fanaticism and the current crisis. And so as long as we continue doing what we've always done, we're going to get what we've always gotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so deep listening, what would that look like to somebody who might be looking at this from you've got to, fight fire with fire because otherwise they'll strike again and it's weakness and so forth. What kind of advice would you, or ideas would you have for somebody to learn more about this, changing this quality?
Oh, that's a really hard one. I think one is to recognize, to really recognize the responsibility that somebody like the president of France has right now. I just can't imagine that the president here did during 9/11. And I think people have to know that they're not alone, that there are others that are deeply listening. But I think there are times when you absolutely can't let people, you can't let terrorists take over, certainly. But the answer is certainly not bombing civilians and tearing countries apart, which I just read an article in The Nation on somebody, this woman who had interviewed all these ISIS people who had been prisoners, actually, and what had motivated them there. And a lot of them were saying they lost their adolescence because of the war. They lost all means of being able to support their family, a lot of it was just plain financial, and some of it was real hate for America for coming in and really forcing them to live in a war-torn country. So now, fast forward, and we're doing that to Syria. So what are the alternatives? I'm not sure that I know, but I am sure that we can't continue to do what we've done. I do think that we need better intelligence, and I do think that we need to understand that the whole idea of interdependence, it's not just an idea. We are all interrelated, and that what we do matters. What we do to each other, we're doing to ourselves. So there has to be some very careful thought about how to respond and what is going to be the most effective response. And we've learned over and over that that's not violence.
Right. Yeah, and we can verify that in our own lives by changing the way our intention when we when we wake up and start our day, it doesn't matter what job we have, if we come from a place of stillness and peace and wanting there to be more love in the world, then it changes our interactions everywhere.
It's so true. And I was just reading something by the Dalai Lama this morning, and he said, "We are all equal members of one and the same family, and the affairs of the entire world are our internal affairs." There's a complete recognition of the internal and the external and how totally interdependent that they are. I mean, can you imagine if we had people running the world who were mindful human beings, what it might look like?
Yeah, right. But also getting back to, because you mentioned that as well, that we can't just be let ourselves be run over, and you know that better than anybody, because you do have to carry a gun, but if you carry it mindfully, then it's like a compassionate action if you do have to use it, and then again, it's a different way of using a gun than if you did it without that coming from that place, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, the focus is always on intention. I mean, what is my intention in this interaction? Is it to stop the violence, to protect more people, or is it coming from a place of anger and vengeance and mm-hmm. punishment? Mm-hmm. Those are two very different places to start an interaction from, whether it's with another individual or with another country.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I really appreciate what you're saying, because, you know, a lot of people would look at Buddhism or any of the people that talk about peace and mindfulness, and they'd say, well, but that's not, how does that apply in real situations where there is a threat and you do need to save somebody and you may have to use violence? So I think it's really good to talk about those situations as well.
Well, and people need to understand that there are some encounters that demand the use of force. But again, not as many as people think. And this includes, from a police officer's perspective and the military, I believe. And it can be done in a manner, again, it's from where the intention is. It can be done in a manner that is for the good of the most people possible.
Mm-hmm.
And what would that be? What would that look like? There's a Buddhist parable I remember. I can't remember exactly what they call it, but there was a captain of a ship, and he really had 200 some people on board, and he realized that this guy who came on was going to do great harm to these people. And so very mindfully, he actually killed a man, and his act, he said, was out of love and compassion and to keep him from having to live with the karma of what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A very different intention than a very different place to start that interaction from than most people would start it from.
Right. Yeah. How would you work with the current situation with where, like you said, the police is being and the African American community are kind of at odds in some places? What kind of advice how would you change that on a structural, systemic level?
Well, first, I think that people have to understand that this isn't just a police issue. So questions have to be asked. Why has racial profiling happened? And why is it happening? And how does it happen in my own organization? Where are the individual and organizational decision-making points where race is and can be a factor? And that is certainly, race is and can be a factor in deciding who to stop. And that's where it starts. But the first thing I would stress is that this isn't just a question for police officers, but, mm-hmm. but for all of us. How do we become more aware of the conscious and unconscious bias operating in our individual and organizational decision making? And how do we begin to monitor and shift the unconscious agreements that lead to racial profiling? So, for example, I don't think there are any, or many officers, there's certainly, I'm only talking about my own department. I can't talk about others. I don't think there were many officers in my own department who were walking around with the conscious belief that one race was superior to another.
Right.
But if you're walking around with unconscious biases of any kind, let's take it out of the race context for a minute. Let's say I believe Ford drivers are more likely to commit traffic offenses than Chevy drivers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop more Ford drivers. I'm going to sit outside Ford dealerships. I'm going to try to put myself in positions to be where Ford drivers would be. And then I'm going to stop a lot more Ford drivers than Chevy drivers. And because I stop so many more, I'm going to arrest more. And therefore, I am going to reinforce my own bias.
Right.
And the analogies are obvious, right? I think that that is what happens. And what makes it worse is that the racial disparities actually get worse at each point in the system. So, for example, they start with who stopped. The racial disparities are so, they've been researched, it's so clear there. But who gets arrested is another decision-making point. Who gets actually charged from who's arrested is another decision-making point in terms of who gets prosecuted. Who gets sentenced and how they get sentenced and whether or not they get sentenced to jail or prison is another decision-making point. And then you have all kinds of decision-making points once somebody's actually incarcerated in terms of who gets conduct violations, who gets parole, who gets treatment. The list goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So it's my responsibility as somebody who has been a member working in the criminal justice system to define where those decision-making points are and to do what I can about them. And I think that it's important for all of us, no matter where we work, to do exactly the same thing.
And what would be something you would recommend an organization do to reveal or to expose these subconscious or implicit biases?
One of the things is I wouldn't recommend that they put a talking head up there and have a diversity training.
Right.
People are just resentful about that. I have found that there are some experiential things that can be really, really helpful in not just dealing with, so for example, with racial profiling, we know police officers have this mechanism for training. It's called FATS training, where they go into simulated situations where they have to make decisions about whether to shoot or don't shoot with these infrared weapons, mm-hmm. right, that aren't real guns, but that will mark if they made the right decision or not. It's a training exercise. So police officers are very familiar with that. So why couldn't you use the same sort of technology and have police officers making stops and talk through exactly what's going through their minds and why they're stopping whom for what reason?
Mm-hmm.
So you could do that. But the other thing I think that's very, very important, and this can be done anywhere, is it's not so much what the mission statement of an organization is what are the unconscious agreements that peers or employees socialize each other to? What are those they're usually unconscious, they're usually unspoken, they're usually not talked about. You won't find them on paper.
Right.
So it's important to get people together and just ask questions. So you, for example, when I was a young officer, I can remember the first thing I got taught is where to go get a free cup of coffee. By the time that I was a sergeant, I was interested in examining that norm. So it wouldn't have done me any good to say, hey, I'm ordering you not to go to that PDQ store because I know they're giving free coffee and I see four squad cars out there at times. That would have been a joke. But if I can get people together and say, hey, I know from the time I came on this department that I was told where there were free cups of coffee. So let's just talk about it. I mean, is it okay? And I've had those discussions. And when people talk about it, they raise their own consciousness. And they might have disagreements about it, but it's out there, and the norm is challenged. And I think that's how you, work to change ethical climates of organizations. Is you bring unconscious agreements into the conscious arena of dialogue, and you don't tell people to do things, but you make inquiries.
Right, but you are talking here about. In some extent, with some organizations, that would be considered challenging the status quo, and not everyone would be open to that, especially if it's a top down type of organization where if you question anything, you automatically, you know, your promotion is up for you know, maybe lower. What would you say in those cases where people are afraid to speak out about something like that?
Well, until I rose through the ranks and was a captain, I could do, but you know, everybody works in a team, and everybody, at least in policing, I wasn't doing this in the entire organization. I was talking to my team about this.
Oh, yeah.
And asking these questions. There were seven or eight people, but what seven or eight people do matters.
Yeah,
that forms ripple effects.
Right.
They then talk to seven or eight more people. And you can also, you know, there are ethics scenarios that also can be done and acted out, 20 people at a time. I wouldn't do these things in a group of 100 any more than I'd put out an order in a group of 100. I mean, the order is already there. It's in the policy manual. Don't accept free things.
Right.
There are good reasons for that, but it's like, well, think of the gossip that goes on in organizations. How many organizations have a culture where you try to recruit somebody to your viewpoint behind closed doors? And a lot of time is spent doing that.
Yeah.
So what if people made an agreement not to do that?
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
And I took responsibility for enforcing that. I did that with a team of mine. It was the greatest, it was the most satisfying and wonderful work experience I ever had.
Yeah.
And I said, look, folks, I'm not going to be the one watching this. You're the ones that have to take responsibility for it, so let's not agree to it unless we all want to. And I used the fourth mindfulness training. Basically, I said to them, how would it be, since we are all talking about not liking the politics of the gossip that goes on in this organization and it being very stressful, if we made a decision that if we had a complaint to take it directly to the person we had it with or to somebody who could do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's,
and they wanted to do it.
That's great. And you, so, but you had a little bit of buy-in when you were able to do that?
I didn't say let's do this. I asked everybody, what's the major stressor going on here?
Yeah.
And that's what they came up with: gossip, politics of the organization. Well, what if we did something just on our team? I said I'm not going to order anybody to do this. It wouldn't be effective. I'm asking you if you want to do this and how and. We don't make an agreement to do it unless everybody's on board with it and everybody agrees to police each other and themselves around it.
Yeah.
And they did.
That's great.
And then they brought it to the recruits and asked them to buy into that.
Yeah, so there you changed the whole system there, the whole organizational culture.
Well, and this all started, what's interesting for me, it all started in 2002. I was at Plum Village and I was chopping vegetables with somebody, and I said, I just have this ridiculous image of seeing police officers walking hand in hand and trying to make peaceful steps on the earth. And at that point, of course, I was still a police officer. And this person said to me, sure, you can make that happen. You can make that happen.
Yeah.
And Thursday, the day after she said that to me with a question and answer session with Ty, I asked Ty to come do a retreat for police officers. He shocked me by saying, I don't think we wait for 2 years. I think we do it next year. And in 2003 in Wisconsin, there was a retreat for police officers.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
That woman does not know. She does not know the ripple effects of what she said to me.
Yeah, that's
She
amazing.
Will never know what she started.
Yeah. Yeah. Her practice was so much part of her that it just came out without hesitation.
It came out without hesitation, and I can't even remember her name. I can't even remember what she looks like, but I can remember the impact that she had on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you have a complete stranger that started all of these ripple effects that have reverberated on and on.
And is this something that you would recommend for all police departments to have a once-a-year retreat, or what's your thinking on that?
Well, I am working with somebody out east in the D.C. area to hold a retreat for police officers next year on the East Coast. So I'm hoping that we will get a lot of people there. One of the things in terms of deep listening and understanding that I think has to happen is I really believe that trust isn't going to be restored between police departments and their communities without dialogue. And I think police officers have to meet in small groups with community members, and we have to tell each other. Community members have to tell police officers. Police officers have to tell community members what it's like for them.
Yeah.
And listen to each other. That has more of an impact than anything else I can think of.
Yeah,
at the end of that retreat I talked about for police officers, Ty asked to hear from the police officers. I have never heard police officers share like that in my life. And I have never seen a community respond to them like they did. And that had a big impact on me. I think that has to be replicated. And communities also have to put pressure on their police departments. They have to understand what it's like, but they all also have to ask questions. What is your standard for using deadly force? Police officers have the ability to use and employ state-sanctioned violence, and communities have the right to know under what circumstances they're using it and why and how it's being trained for.
Mm-hmm.
And those are important questions that every community needs to ask.
Yeah, definitely. Is there anything else that you would recommend to someone who doesn't currently have a place to go to retreat, where they can cultivate some peace in their mind and heart in the midst of the suffering and violence right now, that they could do right now or whenever they get in their patrol car or whatever job they have that may have some conflict?
Well, I think a few things I can think of. One is to understand the cycle. So many people are either very, very hypervigilant to keep themselves safe, or which produces a lot of adrenaline, or multitasking. Lots of people in lots of jobs are multitasking like crazy. But especially people who are responding to traumas, there's a lot of adrenaline produced in those situations. And the research shows that adrenaline pushes you out of the normal place, and then it takes 24 hours for that to return to normal, but people go back to work before that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times what people are experiencing is this spike were at the top of it. You know, they're on the top of their game. They're humorous. They can make decisions. They're not procrastinating. And then they're going home, and they're listless. They don't have any energy. They start to project that onto the people who are at home in terms of, well, where am I feeling good? I'm feeling better at work. At home is where I feel like I just can't catch up, can't make decisions, procrastinating, a lot of the things that look like depression at the bottom of that cycle. And I see it over and over and over. And there are people who have researched and talked about it. So one has to do some very proactive things. And I think one of the most important is watering the seeds of joy. Mm-hmm. So what are people's Zen activities? What are the things you really, really like to do? But here's the trick. If you wait until you feel like doing them, you're not going to do them. But if you schedule them proactively, you will do them. So that's one thing, is water the seeds of joy. When you're actually at work, there are a number of things. You can take 3 breaths each time you get a call before you respond, before you do anything. Just take 3 breaths. Mm-hmm. You can find reasons to take 3 breaths during your shift or your work. If you get a lunch break where you can actually go off the street, you can choose to eat mindfully. If you work in an office, you can close your door, spend 15 minutes eating mindfully rather than eating, trying to be on the computer and trying to drive everything else. But I think the most important thing anybody can do is to develop a daily practice to learn how to still and disengage from your mind, and to learn how to understand that, you know, your thoughts aren't the truth.
Right.
That they're a result of your conditioning. When you really get that, things become very, very different. And you get that through practice. You get that through being still. You get that through learning how to be mindful. And there are so many tools available for us. Every single person who has access to a computer has access to a podcast. And there are so many people out there offering tools in how to meditate and mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And if you're a police officer, go to the Center for Mindfulness and Justice, watch the calendar, come to the retreat, pick up Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Keeping the Peace, which came out of the retreat he held for police officers.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. And I think part of it too, because I was thinking about my first retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh was self-acceptance, because I guess that's a problem, especially in the West, is that we have a lot of self-loathing. You know, like those 3 breaths, if you don't even think you deserve that, then that could be a problem. That could be another obstacle. To me, that seems like that's another part of it.
That's so important. I think Pema Chodron said that she gets the same letter from every one of her students in some form. And that letter is, I'm the worst person in the world, help me.
Yeah.
that in some way it's like that. And you know, right away there is one thing that we can do about that. And that's we can undo what the Buddha called the second arrow. In other words, an event happens with my son that is extremely stressful and leads to suffering. That suffering, that is, it's an event that has occurred. But if I start to say bad mother to myself, that's the level of suffering, that's suffering added to suffering.
Right.
That's the second arrow. That's the level of suffering that we do control. And that's another thing that meditation and mindfulness help us do. They help us recognize our self-talk.
Yeah.
And it's so helpful. They help us recognize our judgments. And they help us become friendly with ourselves. So, for example, you know, one of the questions I started asking myself through meditation was, when will I be enough? And what would make me enough?
Mm-hmm.
Those were great questions to ponder. Another one that I started asking myself is, what would I do in this situation if I didn't have an ego to protect, defend, or build up? What would my action look like? So, you know, this practice is really, it's not about a goal of enlightenment. It's about transformation.
Mm-hmm.
It's about transformation and freedom.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Getting those arrows out of the way, very freeing.
Or learning not to shoot them in the first place.
Right. Saving all that energy.
Wouldn't that be freeing? Yeah.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else besides the Center for Mindfulness and Justice that you want to share for people to go find?
No, I just think that there are so many wonderful resources and teachers out there right now that what I just want people to do is to take advantage of all of them. And of course, Ty has so many podcasts out there now too. But I think retreats are so important. You get from, if you've never been to a retreat, it's like an acceleration. You get from a retreat, which you might get from 60 times of trying to sit and meditate. And it's so,
right.
Not only do you get instruction, but you get, you know, you have other people and you all contribute energy and you're contributing to it and you're drawing from it and you're letting you're letting the details, the to-do list, go for 3 or 4 days so that you can totally devote yourself to this. And so I would say go to a retreat. Find a retreat and go to it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, for sure. Thanks again, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Same to you. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Sherry Maples. You can find the show notes by going to meditationfreedom.com/39. Feel free to leave any more questions or comments after what you've heard on this interview, and we'll do our best to respond. And I didn't mention this in the episode, but there was one more anecdote that I recall my Tai Chi teacher talking about when she was still alive and teaching. She mentioned an instance in New York City where she was taking a subway, and a couple of guys wanted to rob her and threaten her. And of course, this is all anecdotal, but nevertheless, the story made an impression on me back when I was taking Tai Chi lessons from her in the late 80s. And she mentioned that when those guys threatened her and were ready to go after her purse, she took on her Tai Chi posture and did her deep breathing and so forth. And if you know Tai Chi, it's a very solid, graceful set of postures, but it's very, very solid and very grounded. And she must have made an impression because they decided to not go after her. And that was, for her, that was her example of, hey, you know, something is happening when I practice that changes the way, that affects the way the interactions go with other people, and in cases of potentially escalating situations that they de-escalate. And she didn't even have to apply her Tai Chi martial arts to fight these guys off or to defend herself. It was just her own state of mind and her solidity of practice and her transparency to her own inner stillness. So anyway, I thought that might be an interesting, another interesting example to mention. I hope that science and research will go and investigate that further and test these things out. Well, that's all I've got for this week. And next week is Thanksgiving. So for those of you listening in real time, the next week or the next week or two may not have an episode posted. I'd love it if you could fill out the survey specifically for me to get some feedback about this podcast and what it's like for you to listen to it, and just some general comments. It's only 7 questions and a very short survey, and it would be very valuable for me to learn and understand more about what you think of this podcast. So I have some ideas to continue to improve on it. And the address for the survey is meditationfreedom.com/survey. So thanks again so much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.